Good day. This is Kim Harden, and I hope you've been enjoying your holiday season. Today I'm reading the Decatur Herald and Review for Friday, December 26th, 2025. I'll start with the weather. Today you can expect sun and clouds with a high of 61, the wind from the west 8 to 16 miles an hour, and tonight it'll drop to 42. Saturday, partly sunny. Winds southeast, 8 to 16, high of 57, low of 54. Sunday, cloudy, a little rain, wind 8 to 16, but the high on Sunday will be 63 degrees. Then the bottom drops out. The low will be 17 degrees Sunday night. Monday, you can wake up to, or it will get up to 24 degrees. And the low will be 16. It will be sunny, but breezy and much colder. So get those coats back out. I'll start today's stories with a Christmas story. The Pope delivers a message to the faithful, written by Sylvia Stellacci and Colleen Berry of the Associated Press, set in Vatican City. Pope Leo XIV, during his first Christmas Day message on Thursday, urged the faithful to shed indifference in the face of those who have lost everything, such as in Gaza, those who are impoverished, such as in Yemen, and many migrants who cross the Mediterranean Sea and the American continent for a better future. The first U.S. pontiff addressed some 26,000 people from the loggia overlooking St. Peter's Square for the traditional papal Ubi et Orbi address, Latin for to the city and to the world, which serves as summary of the woes facing the world. While the crowd gathered under a steady downpour during the papal mass inside St. Peter's Basilica, the rain had subsided by the time Leo took a brief tour of the square in the Popemobile, then spoke to the crowd. Leo revived the tradition of offering Christmas greetings in multiple languages, abandoned by his predecessor, Pope Francis. He received especially warm cheers when he made his greetings in his native English and Spanish, the language of his adopted country of Peru, where he served first as a missionary and then as archbishop. Someone in the crowd shouted out, "Viva la Papa," or "Long live the Pope," before he retreated into the basilica. Leo took off his glasses for a final wave. During the traditional address, the Pope emphasized that everyone could contribute to peace by acting with humility and responsibility. If he would truly enter into the suffering of others and stand in solidarity with the weak and the oppressed, then the world would change, the Pope said. Leo called for justice, peace, and stability in Lebanon, the Palestinian territories, Israel, and Syria, prayers for the tormented people of Ukraine, and peace and consolation for victims of wars, injustice, political instability, religious persecution, and terrorism, citing Sudan, South Sudan, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Congo. The Pope also urged dialogue to address numerous challenges in Latin America, reconciliation in Myanmar, the restoration of the ancient friendship between Thailand and Cambodia, and assistance for the suffering of those hit by natural disasters in South Asia and Oceania. In becoming man, Jesus took himself our fragility, identifying with each one of us, with those who have nothing left and have lost everything, like the inhabitants of Gaza, with those who are prey to hunger and poverty, like the Yemeni people, with those who are fleeing their homeland to seek a future elsewhere, like the many refugees and migrants who cross the Mediterranean or traverse the American continent, the pontiff said. He also remembered those who have lost their jobs or are seeking work, especially young people, underpaid workers, and those in prison. Earlier, Leo led the Christmas Day Mass from the central altar beneath the balustrade of St. Peter's Basilica, adorned with floral garlands and clusters of red poinsettias. White flowers were set at the feet of a statue of Mary, Mother of Jesus, whose birth is celebrated on Christmas Day. In his homily, Leo underlined that peace can emerge only through dialogue. There will be peace when our monologues are interrupted and enriched by listening, We fall to our knees before the humanity of the other, he said. He remembered the people of Gaza, exposed for weeks to rain, wind, and cold, and the fragility of defenseless populations tried by so many wars, and of young people forced to take up arms who on the front lines feel the senselessness of what is asked of them and the falsehoods that fill the pompous speeches of those who send them to their deaths. Thousands of people packed the basilica for Pope's first Christmas Day Mass, holding aloft their smartphones to capture images of the opening procession. This Christmas season marks the winding down of the Holy Year celebrations, which will close on January 6th, the Catholic Epiphany holiday, marking the visit of the three wise men to the baby Jesus in Bethlehem. Multiple stories today on the Illinois jail system, so we'll focus on a few of those. Beginning with the first story titled, A Fractured System. This is a public service journalism report brought to you by Annalisa Trofimuk and Drew Zimmerman. An investigation into nearly 100 Illinois jail cases shows repeated medical failures that left people injured, suffering, or dead before their cases were heard. Caged in a cell, Jared Trailer struggled to breathe and cried out for help, pleading that he felt like he was dying, and it turned out his feelings of despair were exactly right. 4 days after his pleas for help started, Trailer died alone in Central Illinois' Tazewell County Jail. He was 31. Fellow inmates said after Trailer died on August 26, 2017, that they heard him begging for assistance as he gasped for air, according to documents in a federal lawsuit filed by his mother. Sweating profusely, hallucinating, and suffering chest pains, he can be seen on jail surveillance video, which was reviewed by Lee Enterprises reporters, repeatedly pressing a call button for help that never arrived. Trailer paid the price of public indecency charges with a far greater sentence than the law would prescribe. An autopsy showed that he died from dysrhythmia, a heart condition medical experts say was related to alcohol and drug use, but exacerbated by dehydration in the jail. If just one person would have listened, maybe things could be different, said Trailer's mother, Lisa Parrish. But instead, they chose to turn their heads the other way. Trailer's case reflects a systemic problem. The Lee Enterprise public service journalism team and the Pantograph spent over a year reviewing nearly 100 cases like his, revealing a pattern of inconsistent care and gaps in oversight at county jails throughout the state. As part of the investigation, reporters spoke to dozens of family members, advocates, lawmakers, and local law enforcement officials, reviewed inspection records and medical contracts for all of the state's 91 county jails, and toured several facilities throughout the state. Unlike prisons, which house individuals convicted of offenses with sentences greater than 1 year, jails are short-term facilities, meaning to temporarily detain subjects pre-trial or who are convicted of minor offenses. While many lawsuits filed by inmates for improper treatment are ultimately dismissed, the complaints offer a window into a fractured system in which complex medical needs often far exceed local resources to address them. As a result, some endure suffering, life-altering injury, or death before their case has even gone to trial. Of the roughly 100 cases filed within the last 15 years, Lee Enterprises journalists reviewed at least 13 people died while in custody, including Michael Carter, Macon County Jail in 2015, Jared Trailer, Tazewell County Jail 2017, Tiffany Rusher, Sangamon County Jail 2017, David Brown, Woodford County Jail 2017, Marcus Mays, Will County Jail 2018, Dalen Key, Macon County Jail 2019, Alyssa Lindhorst, Madison County Jail 2020, Blake Lee, Woodford County Jail 2021, Eric Peterson, Rock Island Jail, 2022, Kyla Evans, Lake County Jail, 2022, Renata Aguilar-Hurtado, DuPage County Jail, 2023, Michael O'Connor, Cook County Jail, 2023. The problem of preventable deaths of pretrial detainees has grown over time. Nationwide, about 1,200 people died in local jails in 2019, a roughly 33% increase from 2000, according to data from the Bureau of Justice Statistics. Of those who died in 2019, about 77% had not been convicted of a crime, and almost 40% of them died a week or less into their detainment. Having handled hundreds of wrongful death cases tied to jails and prisons, attorney Lewis Meyer points to a common theme, a breakdown in communication. Among the staff and medical providers at many facilities, there's either people that just don't care or think detainees are crying wolf, said Meyer of Chicago-based Meyer & Kiss. A lot of times you can ignore it and the problem goes away and nothing happens, he said. Unfortunately, many times you ignore it and the problem doesn't go away and gets worse. And then I'm getting a call from a grieving family asking me, what happened to my son? What happened to my daughter? Money is what it comes down to. County sheriffs and jail administrators say they are doing the best they can with available resources. We have limited capabilities in the corrections setting to provide medical care at some of the levels of individuals that come into us, said Rock Island County Sheriff Darren Hart. The Rock Island County Jail is located in Illinois near the Iowa border along the Mississippi River. Even though the jail has access to more mental health services than others, they are still weak in spots, Hart said. It's not the level of care that these individuals need, he added. To compensate for a lack of staffing or resources, most counties contract with private health care providers, which is viewed as a more cost-effective and efficient approach than hiring additional county employees. Other facilities turn to nonprofit organizations for care, while some counties rely on their own health departments to meet the growing demand. In the Tazewell County Jail, Trailer's life was in the hands of correctional officers and a company called Correct Care Solutions. It merged with another company in 2018 to become WellPath, which provides health care for hundreds of jails, prisons, and other detention facilities across 37 states. Advanced Correctional Healthcare, another one of the nation's largest jail health care providers, contracts with almost half of the jails in Illinois and more than 350 facilities across 21 states. These companies may administer services, but providing additional staffing can be an uphill battle for them as well. Livingston County recently dropped ACH as their health care provider, with Sheriff Ryan Bohm citing unresolved staffing issues. Multiple other counties across the country have dropped ACH within the last 18 months after finding more cost-effective alternatives. Peoria County Jail Administrator Carmisha Turner said the county rebid for medical services after its contract with ACH expired and chose to move forward with WellPath. The ever-changing environment. While state law outlines some fundamental standards, the quality of care and availability of some services can vary wildly between counties. Meyer, who focuses heavily on litigation in such cases, said this can be true even when two jails have the same care provider. He recalled one example in which two neighboring counties with similar populations had very different ways of treating inmates going through withdrawal from drugs or alcohol. One county had a policy and how to monitor and look for it, Meyer said. The other one didn't even have a policy, yet it was the same company working for both of them. The patchwork of providers makes it difficult to enforce and regulate standardized care, and with limited resources and staffing, county jails continue to fill the gap for their roles they are not designed or properly staffed for, such as substance abuse centers, mental health facilities, and hospitals. Former Macon County Jail Director of Nursing, Tamika Riemann, described the environment of working in a jail similar to that of an emergency room. We see everything from an earache to STD to a pregnant person to a suicidal person. Riemann also said in an interview last year, you have to be able to handle the ever-changing environment. She added that this is one of the factors that makes it difficult to find and retain medical workers. If inmates are not getting the treatment they need, their options are limited unless they file with an internal complaint with the jail or pursue legal action. Most instances of poor care go unreported. ACH President and CEO Jessica Young wrote in an email that the company offers the best quality of health care, and in some cases they have saved lives and received recognition for doing so. The example last year, the company awarded its own staff members with 3 overdose revival awards and 1 life-saving award for reviving a detainee with no pulse. However, ACH has also been involved in a number of lawsuits which they have been accused of improper care. A 2020 lawsuit alleges the company, as part of its pitch to prospective jails, claims to avoid major costs by having detainees with the worst medical emergencies released on their own recognizance or sent somewhere else. The plaintiff in this 2020 case, Nicholas Banning, had been in custody of the Shelby County Jail for 4 days before he was released on his own recognizance and transferred to a local hospital after his health deteriorated from opioid dependency and withdrawal symptoms that went unacknowledged and untreated. Banning's medical expenses after spending 2 months in the hospital would total about $750,000. When asked about this, Young said the accusation of cost saving is absurd. ACH's contracts are structured so that there is no financial incentive to deny care. We are not responsible for paying the hospitalization or pharmaceuticals, said Young. In fact, poor care results in more lawsuits, which are costly, so we are not motivated to do a bad job. Rather, we encourage both the health care and security teams. Unless otherwise expressed in a third-party contract, off-site services such as hospitalization and ambulance transportation typically are covered by the county. In limbo, suffering. For years, Illinois municipalities have experienced a decline in medical and mental health workforces, as well as the loss of community resources and institutions to treat their most vulnerable populations. At one time, the number of beds available to treat jail inmates with severe mental health problems was in the tens of thousands. That number now hovers around 1,000. Sheriffs and jail superintendents interviewed for this series say their biggest challenges when it comes to health care are handling inmates with extreme mental health concerns and those who are experiencing opioid and alcohol withdrawal. Many of those officials addressed the need for a change to the overall system, which includes changes at the state level. "I really don't have the ability to fully treat these individuals," said Sangamon County Jail Superintendent Beck. "And as a result of that, they're sitting here in limbo, suffering." Roughly 1 year ago, the Sangamon County Jail was holding 10 inmates deemed unfit to stand trial. In total, these inmates had spent 722 days in custody since their evaluation, according to Beck. If an inmate's condition continues to deteriorate, whether they are considered unfit or not, they will be taken to a local hospital for evaluation, he added. Many jails keep track of these medical histories for repeat offenders. In Livingston County, Jail Superintendent Lisa Draper said any questions about an officer's conduct when a subject is arrested is documented and archived in the jail's job management system. If a repeat offender is hospitalized for a mental health condition or is suicidal at the time of the arrest, that will be flagged on the person's file. Young said in an email that the treatment inmates receive in jail is better than what they would get on the street. Many incarcerated people cannot access treatment in the community and are not aware of their medical history and/or don't realize the importance of their current medical condition, Young wrote. In addition, when they come into jail, they are too fearful of catching additional charges to provide the healthcare team with an honest health history, such as substance abuse. She added that legislation geared toward providing immunity to patients in exchange for honest substance abuse history would be a major step in the right direction. Parrish, meanwhile, believes her son might still be alive had his life not been in the hands of the Correct Care Solutions and Tazewell County Jail. "He needed medical attention," she said. "If he was on the street and saying, 'I need help,' somebody would have called 911. He was totally dependent, alone, to take care of his needs. He was not even allowed to make a phone call or to call me. They are people, too." Parrish remembers her son as having a caring heart, even as a child. "If you were the kid down at the end of the street that people were making fun of, he was making friends with you," she said. As an adult, Traylor never shied away from helping his mother with anything she needed, from moving her into a new house to helping her with car repairs she needed. The two were very close and bonded over a love of music. Some of their favorite bands to listen to together were AC/DC and the Rolling Stones. "I miss my son dearly. I miss seeing his face coming in the door and making me laugh." When Traylor was booked into Tazewell County Jail, he was put in a special housing unit, a cell block for inmates experiencing a range of situations from mental health issues to opioid and alcohol withdrawal. As he suffered symptoms of alcohol withdrawal, including chest pains and hallucinations, a correct care nurse at the jail found that his blood pressure had risen dramatically, according to court documents. Between the three times his blood pressure was recorded and his complaining about chest pains, the staff was aware there was a need for medical attention. But at no point was Traylor seen by a doctor or transferred to a hospital, court records allege. Well past contracts with various counties, including Tazewell, have stipulated that the company is required to identify members of the jail population with medical or mental health conditions, which either could be worsened as a result of being incarcerated or would require extensive care. The sheriff is then informed of these at-risk detainees and must make every effort to have such an inmate released, transferred, or otherwise removed from the correctional setting. After having spent hours trying to get comfortable in the jail, around 9:34 a.m., August 26, 2017, Traylor lay down in his cell with his head on a table and his body on the bed. When a nurse and two other correctional staff members arrived in his cell around 10:12 a.m., Traylor was cold to the touch, court records said. An hour and a half later, Illinois State Police officers arrived and took photos of the scene. After his death, Parrish filed a lawsuit on August 24, 2018, against the county and Correct Care Solutions, Inc. According to jail documents, the jail and medical staff blamed Traylor's death on frequent alcohol and drug use. While those factors were cited as contributing, the autopsy report illustrates that the details surrounding his death are much more complex. Dr. Matthew Fox, the forensic pathologist who conducted Traylor's autopsy, said the cause of his death was cardiac dysrhythmia, also known as an irregular heartbeat, due to hypertensive cardiovascular disease. Dr. Brian Stubich, an expert witness who reviewed the videos from Traylor's cell and his medical records, stated in his report that Traylor died of preventable causes. He added that the high temperature of his cell, due to a lack of proper ventilation or air conditioning, contributed to his symptoms. Stubich's report also said that CCS medical jail staff failed to perform proper medical intake, did not have Traylor transported and evaluated due to his initial complaint, did not perform tests for appropriate vital signs, nor take action and address abnormal vital signs such as the elevated blood pressure. Tazewell County agreed to a settlement in November 2020. The claims against Correct Care Solutions were dismissed in their entirety. Everyone needs to realize that they are someone's life. This is someone's brother, friend, father, not just an inmate. They are people too, said Parrish. About this series, for decades, some people booked into Illinois County jails have suffered serious injuries and even death after having underlying medical conditions, mental health problems, or substance abuse disorders go untreated. Marcus Mays, 30, was in Will County Jail for 11 days when he died after a grand mal seizure in 2018. Jared Traylor, 31, was only in the custody of the Tazewell County Jail for 4 days before he died of a heart condition related to prior drug use and alcohol that was exacerbated by dehydration. Alyssa Lindhorst, 28, spent almost 4 days in the Madison County Jail before dying of untreated withdrawal symptoms. A year-long investigation by Lee Enterprises' public service journalism team and the Pantograph determined that these preventable deaths are not isolated to a particular jail or region. Between 2000 and 2019, the number of deaths of detainees in the custody of a jail nationwide ranged between 888 and 1,200 annually, according to data from the Bureau of Justice Statistics. However, this number may not reflect the total number of deaths of individuals in custody due to changes to federal reporting requirements over the last decade. Many of the lawsuits reviewed can be traced back to correctional or medical staff either ignoring or not identifying the severity of a medical or mental health condition and confirming the proper treatment that should be administered. Ensuring that detainees receive adequate medical and mental health services can be hindered by a lack of standardized health care within jails. These facilities are further handcuffed by lack of funding and a shortage of qualified staff. Jennifer McDermott of the Associated Press writes this next story titled Clean Energy Outlook, Advocates Optimistic for 2026 Despite Year of Policy Headwinds. Clean energy had a roller coaster year as President Donald Trump worked to boost polluting fossil fuels while blocking wind and solar, dozens of energy developers, experts, and politicians say. Surveyed by the Associated Press, many described 2025 as turbulent and challenging for clean energy, though there was progress as projects connected to the energy grid. They said clean energy must continue to grow and meet skyrocketing demand for electricity to power data centers and lower Americans' utility bills. Solar builder and operator Jorg Vargas said it was a very tough year for clean energy. As Trump criticized renewable energy and Republicans' tax and spending cuts law dramatically rolled back tax breaks for clean energy. There was a cool-down effect this year, the co-founder and CEO of Aspen Power said. Having said that, we are a resilient industry. Plug Power President Jose Luis Crespo said this year's policy recalibration and technological progress will shape clean energy's trajectory for years to come. Policy whiplash. The year began with ample federal subsidies for clean energy technologies, a growing number of U.S.-based companies making parts and materials for projects in high demand from states and corporations, said Tom Harper, partner at global consultant Beringa. Since then, subsidies were stripped back, the supply chain weakened, costs rose due to tariffs, and some customers questioned their commitment to clean energy. Harper said he described the year as a paradigm shifting. The federal government canceled grants that sought to block projects. The Republicans' tax law reversed or steeply curtailed clean energy programs Democrats established in 2022. Wayne Wingarden at the Pacific Research Institute think tank said the time came for alternative energy to demonstrate viability without subsidies. Fossil fuels also receive subsidies. Many energy executives said the GOP law was the most consequential policy shift. It reshaped the economics of clean energy projects, drove a rush to start construction before incentives expire, and forced developers to reassess their strategies for acquiring parts and materials, Leonard Henricks said. He leads the expansion of TWAICE in the Americas, providing analytics software for battery energy storage systems. Companies can't make billion-dollar investments with so much policy uncertainty, American Clean Power Association CEO Jason Grumet said. Consequently, greenhouse gas emissions will fall at a much lower rate than previously projected in the U.S., said Brian Murray, director of the Nichols Institute for Energy, Environment, and Sustainability at Duke University. Solar storage boom. Solar and storage accounted for 85% of the new power added to the grid to the first 9 months of the Trump administration, according to Wood Mackenzie Research. That's because the economic remains strong, demand is high, and the technologies can be developed quickly, Enza Renewables CEO Mike Hall said. Solar energy company Sol Systems said that it had a record year as it brought its largest utility-scale project online and grew its business. The energy storage systems company, CMBLU Energy, said storage clearly stands out as a winner this year, moving from optional to essential. Trump's effort to manipulate government regulation to harm clean energy just isn't enough to offset the natural advantages that clean energy has, Democratic Senator U.S. Sheldon Whitehouse said. The direction is still all good. The Solar Energy Industries Association said regardless of policies, solar and storage will grow as the backbone of the nation's energy future. Nuclear and geothermal. Democrats and Republicans supported investing to keep nuclear reactors online, restart previously closed reactors, and deploy new advanced reactor designs. Nuclear power is carbon-free source of electricity, though not typically labeled as green energy like other renewables. Who had restart Three Mile Island on their 2025 bingo card, Beringa said. Partner David Shepard. The Pennsylvania plant in 1979 was the site of the nation's worst commercial nuclear power accident. The Energy Department will loan $1 billion to help finance a restart. Everyone loves nuclear, said Darren Kaiser, executive vice president at Edelman. It helps that the technology for small modular reactors is starting to come to fruition, he said. Benton Arnett, a senior director at the Nuclear Energy Institute, said the need for clean, reliable power intensifies. We will look back on the actions being taken now as laying the foundation. The Trump administration also supports geothermal energy, and the tax law largely preserved geothermal tax cuts. The Geothermal Rising Association said technologies continue to mature and produce, making 2025 a breakthrough. I need to close for part one and finish this story in part two for December 26, 2025, Decatur Herald and Review. This is Kim Harden. I'll be right back.